Network.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. More than 180 American soldiers have died in the war against Iraq. 47 of them have died in the past 6 weeks. That is, after the time the president declared major combat operations at an end. For the American soldiers in Iraq, peacetime is looking a lot like wartime. The U.S. military's latest response to the resistance is an offensive sweep in search for militants west of Baghdad. The Pentagon calls it Operation Desert Scorpion. It comes right after another move through the towns north of the capital, in which 400 Iraqis were arrested. It's one thing for the American forces to seize illegal weapons and to defend itself against the snipers. It is quite another thing to understand the exact nature of this resistance. Connection listeners, if the war in Iraq is not over, then how should it be fought today? Are more soldiers needed? Should America take an even more aggressive stand against the Iraqi resistance, or will that only make matters worse? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we will be talking today with experts in military planning and history. We're going to start with Eli Lake. He is State Department correspondent for UPI, and he's joining us on the line from Washington, D.C. Eli, welcome to The Connection.
Thank you for having me.
I've been hearing over the weekend increasing calls from Democratic presidential contenders and others in the Democratic Party about criticism on the war plan. But I gather that you're hearing increased debate within Republican circles about what's going on and what should be done next.
Well, I think that at this point you're seeing a divide over exactly how to vet Iraqis for the new civil administration inside of Iraq. There's a real debate over what sources of intelligence to trust at this point, and that has a real effect in terms of who you're going to hire to be part of the new security forces, to be simply cops on the beat, because you don't want to have Marines doing that, and you certainly don't want to necessarily have a long-term presence of internationals coming in who are going to be doing the police functions of a state that we would hope would eventually gradually get its own independence. So what you have on the one hand, I think, is the Wolfowitz wing that would like to include people from Ahmad Chalabi's organization and other exile groups in determining, for lack of a better term, who's naughty and who's nice among the Iraqis who are there right now. And then you've got traditional factions within the CIA, and this has resulted in a lot of confusion, particularly, I think, about a month ago you saw the Marines actually raid Ahmad Chalabi's compound in what was the Hunt Club in Baghdad. This was apparently, according to my sources, a tip from, depending on who you're talking to, some would say that this is a tip from people who were sort of clandestine Baathists who wanted to get rid of Chalabi's folks. But then there were also complaints about Chalabi's own militia. So it's very, very confusing right now finding just who are the Iraqis who are going to try to keep security and peace and order in Baghdad and, for that matter, the rest of the country.
Eli, the plan has always been, in the words of the administration, to stay as long as necessary and not one day longer. Regardless of how and who's debating this, is this all about trying to get out as quickly as possible?
I don't necessarily think that's true. I think in every single war the United States has fought overseas, you always see it first an effort by the political leadership to say, we're not going to stay that long, this is not going to be this is not going to be another Vietnam. But the truth of the matter is that in Iraq, we never really saw an army or a government surrender. What you saw was an army and a government vanish. And I think that right now the United States is dealing with the remnants of that vanished state. In many cases, it was probably not such a great move to entirely disband the army, because what you've done is you've put a bunch of young people on the street who don't know how to do anything except for shoot an AK-47. And those people, you know, need jobs. And if they can't have their old jobs or their old pensions, then the result is probably that they're going to find a local warlord or something like that to work for, because the economics are at play here as well.
So Eli, I'm going to be speaking shortly to David Rohn in Baghdad about what he's hearing there. What I'd like to just close with you on is the debate that you're hearing in Washington one of criticism now, like one side saying you screwed up in planning this war, no, you know, the war changed. Again, within Republican circles, how acrimonious is that now?
Well, it's low level because right now everyone's going to be coming behind the president, particularly because it's heating up in you're not going to see this very publicly, but there's a huge concern inside the administration and within Republican circles about what Paul Bremer means when he says de-bathification. Who's a bathist at this point? I mean, the truth of the matter is that you couldn't have any job in any part of the civil service in Iraq unless you were a member of the Ba'ath Party. And I would say that the people who have supported Ahmad Shalabi for these many years would like a very broad definition of de-bathification, where there are others who are looking for a looser definition of that. And this all comes down to the intelligence problem, and it all comes down to, you know, who helped the United States before the war, and there's going to be a lot of debate about that. And because there was very poor intelligence sharing before the war and the war planning, and there was so controversial as we're finding now in the debate about where are the weapons and so forth, these debates are carrying over and spilling over into who to hire into the new Iraqi police force and so forth and so on.
Eli, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Eli Lake is State Department correspondent for UPI. And as I said, we're going now to Baghdad. David Rhodes on the line. He's a correspondent with the New York Times. David, welcome back to The Connection.
Thank you.
Tell me, I don't know if you had a chance to hear much of what Eli was talking about, but how are the Americans in Baghdad, in Iraq, trying to decide who they can work with and who the really bad guys are?
At this point, they seem to be using a very strict definition. Anyone who is, I believe, considered a level 1, 2, or 3 Ba'athist Party leader is barred from jobs. I know they've been very strict in terms of vetting police officers, and you know, that's the policy now coming from Paul Bremer.
Tell me, David, what kind of a shift you're seeing there in Baghdad in U.S. military strategy as we hear reports here in America about Operation Desert Scorpion and Operation Peninsula Strike.
There's definitely an effort, I think, by the U.S. to respond to these ambushes, which were quietly turning into a major problem. There are 10 Americans killed in the last 3 weeks and dozens wounded. Most of them are not in Baghdad. Actually, the feeling itself in Baghdad is calm, and there's been improvements here to the military's credit. Gas lines have shortened. There's much more, many more goods in stores. But there's a real problem out in Sunni-dominated central Iraq. And what they've tried to do now is to carry out targeted raids based on intelligence where they'll go after a specific house. More blunt tactics such as carrying out big sweeps through entire neighborhoods where you'd search house to house for weapons are being discontinued, and they're trying to sort of be more surgical about it. That's a difficult thing to do, though. The military is a blunt and very powerful weapon.
David, is it possible to know at this point how organized the resistance in those towns and villages is?
It's definitely well organized locally, in that the attacks have shifted from people just firing random shots to now there are signals given with flares or people turning flashing lights off and on in houses as to when an American convoy is coming. They're firing at the first vehicle and the lead vehicles of the convoy with small arms and firing RPGs at the center vehicles, and they're targeting lesser armed American convoys, so they're much more sophisticated. Just yesterday, there were 10 American soldiers wounded, and it's not clear, actually, one or two ambushes just north of Baghdad. And that was in an area where the U.S. had just carried out a massive sweep trying to actually arrest the group of men that were thought to be carrying out the ambushes in north of the city. So it's hard. It's too early to tell now whether, you know, the sweeps are working.
And, David, I'd like to hear just a bit from you, if I can, on what you've been writing in the New York Times, and that is the risk that the American military has to run here in using force against these insurgents. Because if they hit them too hard, there's a danger that they're just going to start more resistance as people get angry with the Americans. Where are we in that right now?
I think there's still a sense of gratitude among Iraqis for the removal of Saddam Hussein, and they're happy with that. But there is a growing discomfort, you could say resentment, among Iraqis about being under military occupation. They do not like it. There's frustration, I think, across the board about the lack of definite movement forward on an Iraqi government, then you have these military operations carried out that can complicate that, that can increase the resistance. It's hard to tell. At this point, it seems like it's just sort of Saddam Hussein loyalists that are carrying out the attacks, whether or not they're picking up new participants who are just disgruntled people angry about American tactics, it's hard to know. But essentially, everywhere I've gone and every search I've witnessed, it's resulted in bitter complaints from Iraqis about, I don't know, the indignity. Again, this, you know, this is a military occupation here, and the Iraqis don't want to live under occupation.
Now, what we hear is that the American military leaders are very aware of this danger, and so while on one hand they'll send a group of soldiers out to knock on the doors at 3 o'clock in the morning, they'll also have soldiers in that same neighborhood building a soccer pitch, so, you know, to demonstrate that there's goodwill there. And I guess what I'd like to hear from you is that great group of people in the middle who are trying to decide if they want to have the Americans around or not, where are they being swayed here? Are they seeing that there are supposed to be good intentions behind what the Americans are doing?
I think they are, but I think the clock is ticking on the U.S. effort here, and that great, you know, silent majority in the middle is growing impatient with this, the lack of a formation of the Iraqi government, and the military operations just exacerbate that sense. Yes, the soccer pitches help and repairing schools, but Iraqis are, you know, astute enough to step back and say this is a gesture. The bottom line is, you know, we want a government. You know, is that moving forward? It's an extraordinarily difficult situation for military commanders. In a way, this is a police operation, but all that they have here are soldiers with tanks.
David, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
David Rode is a correspondent with the New York Times. And Connection listeners, you may have had a chance to hear on a broadcast yesterday a senior Iraqi former diplomat, a man by the name of Adnan Pachachi. He was talking with Jim Muir in Baghdad about some of the risks and some of the dangers that come of this, trying to find out what the resistance is and how hard it has to be hit. Let's listen just to a bit of what Mr. Pachachi had to say about the risks involved here.
So far, it seems to me that the violence against the Americans has been rather sporadic and probably individual acts of violence rather than a well-organized and coordinated. But of course, this could happen too. I mean, because there is a lot of discontent, as you know, in the country. People are impatient. They have, they had hoped that things would improve quickly, and they have not improved. And with the, you know, the problems of security and of living conditions, I wouldn't ignore the fact that there could be an explosion, although I don't think it's imminent. But the danger signs are there, of course, and that's why speed seems to be very important. I think the installation of an Iraqi administration quickly would dispel some of these fears and will improve the general situation.
That is Adnan Pachachi in the 1960s. He was Iraq's ambassador to the United Nations, talking in an interview with the BBC. Connection listeners, when we come back, Michael Vickers, Director of Strategic Studies at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, will join us with his view of the situation there. And we'll also have Robert Killebrew with us. He's a veteran strategic planner and retired Army colonel. And we'd like to hear from you as well. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. Could the U.S. military have been better prepared for the opposition it faces now? And if the war is not over, how should it be fought today? I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. I know a number of you have been trying to get through on the number, and there was a hiccup in the line. We have cleared that away, and the lines are open. So we're welcoming your calls on our program about the military situation in Iraq and the options for the Americans at this particular point. The number again, 1-800-423-8255. And I'm joined for the balance of the program now by Michael Vickers. He's Director of Strategic Studies at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. That's a Defense Planning Research Institute. He's also a former Special Forces and CIA officer. He's joining us from studio in Washington. Michael, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
And joining us on the line from North Carolina, Robert Killebrew. He's a veteran strategic planner and retired Army colonel, served in Vietnam and in Central America, and taught military strategy at the Army War College. Robert, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Great. Now, let me start, Michael, with you, because your view from Washington about this resistance that the United States is up against, do you see it as something that is a lot more organized, perhaps even a lot more dangerous than what may have been anticipated?
Well, I think to some extent the administration planned for a different post-war than the one they got. They thought there would be large-scale oil fires 20 or 30 times beyond what they got. Fortunately, they thought there would be large-scale humanitarian assistance needed for refugees, again, 20 or 30 times beyond what they got. But I think we underestimated the extent that this war on the regime, the Ba'athist regime, wasn't over the day the hostilities ended. We may have displaced the regime out of the capital, but there's still tremendous de-Ba'athification that has to take place, and that's what we're seeing now.
Are you saying that these are the former members of the Iraqi army who melted away 6 weeks ago?
I think that the resistance is... such as it is really a combination of Ba'ath Party cadres operating in small groups, Saddam Fedayeen, a former Republican Guard, some foreigners, and then some recruits that they draw to their cause from the population. But I don't think it's organized on a larger level. I think it's really small unit organization or cellular organization.
Okay, Robert Killebrew. Now, David Rode told us earlier in the program that the clock is ticking here, not only in terms of what the American response is, but how well organized those people can be in Iraq, the resistance there. Is that a concern of yours?
I think that's exactly right, and I think Mike hit it right on the nose. When we went in and dropped Baghdad, I think that we had anticipated that the organized resistance would largely cease. That was true to an extent, but what you're seeing now is a coalescing of all the groups that Mike Vickers talked about. I would add there's one other danger also, and that is that as the groups grow and if they continue to resist and if there's a perception they're being successful, there's a danger this could turn into not just a de-Ba'athification problem, but the kind of religious war that we're trying to avoid having to fight at all.
Even though the resistance at this point is coming from the slightly more secular Sunni Muslim people who are loyal to Saddam?
As far as we can tell, that's the case right now. And I might add that from what I see in the open press, the attacks on our soldiers look to be the kinds of things that former soldiers would do. There's a certain amount of military tactics and knowledge involved here. As this goes on, though, if we're not able to stamp this out fairly quickly, there's a danger this could become a rallying call for those people in the Middle East whose motivations are more radical Islamic than Ba'ath Party. And if that happens, we've got a different kind of problem on our hands.
All right, just a note here for our listeners. There are apparently still some glitches in our line. So if you're in the Boston area, a note for you that we have a line for you to call in on. It's 617-353-0645, 617-353-0645. For people elsewhere in the country, please stick with our 1-800 number, 1-800-423-8255. We're trying to get that ironed out. Michael Vickers, I want to come back to you just once again on the resistance here, because I'm curious to know whether or not it's at all possible that this is part of a deliberate strategy which goes back to before the U.S. forces arrived in Baghdad, that Saddam Hussein or his generals, anticipating that they'd really stand no chance against the American high-tech armor, may have said, you know, let's just go to the mattresses for a while, let the Americans get in, let them get comfortable, and then we'll see if we can just plunk away at them.
Well, there seems to be some indication of that. There were some Iraqi intelligence documents that seemed to indicate planning for a post-defeat. But the important thing is they've lost control of a lot of the country. I mean, the areas where there's still pretty significant resistance is really north and west of Baghdad in the Sunni strongholds. Mm-hmm. And that's about it. The resistance that there'd been in the south seems to have petered out, and there never really was much in the north.
Robert, what do you think about the suggestion that this is perhaps part of a strategy that goes back more than just a couple of weeks?
I think there's a strong possibility it was a fallback position, although I don't think that they would have gone to it unless they'd been run out of a more deliberate conventional strategy. I think what we're seeing right now are probably more disorganized groups of small groups of soldiers that banded together to fight. If there's a strategy there, it hasn't coalesced yet.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about what this means for the American planners now. Michael Vickers, a lot of people are saying this is the time to bring in more soldiers, that the Rumsfeld doctrine of small and fast and mean and quick is just not going to work.
Well, we already have brought in more soldiers, and I mean, this is one of the major trends in war, is that it takes more soldiers after the war than it does during the war because of our broad capabilities elsewhere, and that's something I think we're going to have to, we've seen in recent wars, and we're going to see in future ones as well. The important point, though, is while we want to have security over the country as much as we can, the actual military operations need to be as surgical as possible, going after the Ba'ath infrastructure. And the shift from sweeps to targeted raids, which couldn't be done without Iraqi cooperation, I might add, is pretty important. It's also important to really combine it with civil affairs and reconstruction so you win over the broad Iraqi population and you don't fuel the kind of national resistance that Bob Killebrew was referring to earlier.
But, Michael, you're saying not... That thousands more soldiers aren't the answer here.
No, I think the big change that you're really seeing is changes in rules of engagement and strategy, not necessarily because of more soldiers. There have been some addition in Iraq, but the real thing that happened a few weeks ago was really a change in our operational posture.
Bob Killebrew, your idea about whether or not more soldiers should be required, what do you think?
Let me give you two quick answers. First of all, it's important to understand that we can always win the first battle, and that's in fact what we have done, and that's fast and quick and lethal. We did it very well. But the war is not yet over. We're going to have to start thinking in wars in terms of destroying the enemy's conventional capabilities, which we can do better than anybody on the planet, and then occupying and doing the kinds of small targeted raids that Michael was talking about, which is in fact a continuation of the war. This war is not over. We have not yet finished, and as long as we're fighting at the scale we're fighting now in Iraq, this war is not completed.
All right, now, but from both of you here, I was surprised to see in the weekend newspaper some young soldier being quoted saying to the reporter, "You go back and tell Donald Rumsfeld that we want to get our sorry butts out of here. We don't like where we're sleeping. We don't like what we're doing." That seems like the first, you know, I don't want to make too much of it, but it sure seems like a hint of discontent in the way that the war is being managed now.
Well, if it's my turn to talk.
Go ahead.
My reaction is we probably need about one more division of young soldiers like him over there. Remember, though, that some of those troops have been there since last fall, have already fought the war, were packing up to come home when they were told, no, we're going to stay a little longer. For him, this war is going on interminably. And for us, for we who are back in the States watching this happen, it seems to me that at least my solution is to put more soldiers in there so this incipient rebellion can be stamped out quickly, the troops can occupy longer, and then come home sooner. The fact is, and we should know this, the fact is we're going to be in Iraq for a long time. We've been in Bosnia a long time. We're in Kosovo for a long time. We're going to be in Afghanistan for a long time, and yeah, I hope with more soldiers. And we're going to be in Iraq for a while still.
All right, Michael, to you and then to our callers.
Well, I would just underscore what Bob said, and that is that some of the frontline troops had 6 months of deployment overseas, which was very stressful in itself, getting ready for the war. Then they fought the intense war, and now they're on several months of very stressful occupation. So they've been through an awful lot.
All right, our telephone number, 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Let's take our first call here from Madison, Wisconsin. Habu's on the line. Hi, Habu.
Yes, hello.
Thanks for calling.
I was one of those people who was somewhat apprehensive about going into Iraq, not for because I like Saddam, but because of precisely these kinds of questions that the press did not ask. Meaning, how is this going to be stabilized? This is a huge area. It's a desert area. These begged questions, this situation, and yet the press was not forthcoming, and it was not because of any they didn't ask the administration a tough question. And let me just say this. I think the intelligence agencies in the United States are getting a bad rep about faulty intelligence. It was almost, I think, that they had decided that the administration decided what they were going to do.
Abu, I'm getting a little lost here. Are you saying that the media is to blame for what's going wrong in Iraq right now?
To the extent that you didn't ask these tough questions beforehand.
And what would that have changed?
Well, people's views may have changed in this country.
Right.
There wouldn't have been that kind of hysteria to war. But at least we would have been a little more sober about it,
right,
and been more cautious.
And where does that leave us today?
Well, we're in a sticky spot, of course. And, you know, I think people will defend their country no matter what. Nobody likes to have other people point guns at them in their country, as bad as Saddam was, and
okay,
he was a monster.
Okay, this is exactly where I want to be. I mean, if the Iraqis see their opposition to the United States at this point is as defending their country, what's the military option for the U.S. now?
Well, that is the question. And what can the military do? If it applies more force, it can backfire. If it applies less force and leaves, that might be a signal to other militant groups, as one of the guests said,
mm-hmm,
that, you know, here's the moment to drive away the Americans. I mean, we are in a no-win situation.
All right. Michael, what is the risk, in your view, that by bringing in some extra hammers and being that much tougher to put down the resistance at this point, that the American military will simply spark more resistance?
Well, of course, there is that risk, and there have been some broad-based unhappiness with American forces in Iraq. But as your correspondents talked about earlier, the jury is really still out. I mean, the Iraqi people are still happy to have Saddam gone. The resistance is not nationally based as much as we can tell at this point. It does seem to be remnants of the old regime more than nationally based resistance. And a lot of the things that people did predict before the war, such as large-scale ethnic or religious strife and jockeying for power in Iraq, haven't happened.
Robert Killebrew, are you in any way concerned that the type of, you know, Operation Desert Scorpion and stuff like that is going to bring about a stiffening of the resistance?
In a large scale, no.
Yeah.
I think that, in fact, if we didn't now deal forcefully with the kinds of operations we're seeing, it would only get worse and not better. If I could just speak for a second to your call-in concern in one sense, I think the press did ask those questions. I don't think the administration was very forthcoming about their plans for post-war Iraq, because I'm not sure they had any.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Habu, thanks for that call. Next to Oxford, Iowa, and Judy's on the line. Hi, Judy.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I'd like to ask why the press and the military is so surprised that the Iraqis don't like what has happened to them. What do you think would happen if the United States was invaded?
Oh, I think we've lost the line to Judy, but I got enough of that call, Robert Killebrew, to go to you, because you were saying earlier to one of our people here that there was an assumption early on that Iraqi people would be welcoming and friendly to the U.S. military once Saddam Hussein was gone. Was that a wrong assumption?
Well, it turned out to be partly wrong. In military planning, you can hope for the best, but you must always plan for the worst. And I think that one of the small errors the administration made when they were standing this war up was that they assumed the Iraqi people would be more forthcoming and welcoming than they are, and that Iraqi civil society would hang together better than it did.
Yeah.
Neither assumption proved to be true. The other small error was, given those two assumptions, we tried to fight this war with minimum force on the ground. And when you come to the second phase of a war like this, when occupation is necessary and small rebellions have to be put down, you really need those forces there to provide that kind of a secure envelope in which civil society can reemerge. And I think we're paying for that now.
And Michael, how much is the U.S. military in Iraq caught in terms of trying to define itself as occupier or liberator or reconstructor or whatever it is they want to be seen as to the people in that country.
Well, of course, that's the key challenge, is to be looked at as liberator and a temporary provider of stability and reconstructor and not occupier. I mean, occupation is a very problematic symbol for obvious reasons in the Arab world. But I would add, you know, before we see everything as dark here, the glass is at least as half full as it is half empty. Remember, during the second week of the war, everybody was saying the war would last for a long, long time. Even the deposing of the regime in Baghdad, as our supply lines were attacked a little bit. And then a month or so ago, there was great concern that the South would never be stabilized. And so we shouldn't while this new strategy is basically getting underway, we shouldn't just assume that it's just going to get worse. It really is at a potential tipping point.
It seems, though, Michael, like it's the sort of conflict where either the planning was way off or a lot of the planning should have been made up sort of the day before and then the day before, because so much has turned out in a way which is different from what was anticipated and what was predicted.
Well, I think that's in the nature of war and in complex societies. I mean, as Bob Killebrew said earlier, we're very good at quickly taking down a regime. The problem of actually removing the regime from the internals of the society and providing stability and then a sense of security afterwards is a significant challenge, but one that the jury's still out on.
All right, Connection listeners. If the war in Iraq is not over, and there seems to be a consensus among the guests on the program this hour that it is not over, then how should it be fought today? Do you think that more soldiers are needed, or that the soldiers who are there need to be used in a different way? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. We think we've got all the gremlins out of the line, so we invite you to join our conversation this hour. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Appalachian Mountain Club, featuring AMC White Mountain huts for hikers.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. I'm Dick Gordon. With me on the program today, Michael Vickers. He's Director of Strategic Studies at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. That's a Defense Planning Research Institute. Michael's also a former Special Forces officer and CIA Operations Officer with lots of experience in the field. We also have with us on the line Robert Killebrew. He's a veteran strategic planner and retired Army colonel. He served in Vietnam, commanded the 82nd Airborne Division there, and with Joint Forces in Central America as well. And, you know, both of you, as I look at the places where you've been and the war that you've seen, I wonder whether or not you're looking back in military history for whether or not there are examples of what we're seeing in Iraq. Bob, maybe I can just start with you, whether or not the type of resistance and the way it's coalescing in Iraq is in any way indicative of what the United States has seen before.
Well, before I do, I have to correct one thing. I didn't command the 82nd Airborne Division in Vietnam. I'm going to get in trouble if that stays on the air like that.
Oh, I'm glad you corrected that. Thank you.
No, I don't see the Vietnam parallel in this operation yet. I think now what we have is a country that, by and large, seems to be reasonably happy with the way things are going. Certainly, they're chafing under American occupation. But given all that, I think they're happy to see Saddam out, with some loyalists and Ba'ath Party fighters in the middle who are trying to reconstitute some kind of resistance. Mm-hmm. I don't see the kind of Viet Cong movement that we fought in Vietnam yet. If this goes on, though, if it is allowed time to cook into some kind of religious opposition to infidels on the soil of Islam, then we could have a totally different situation.
Michael, what parallels do you see in history here? Is there anything that we can use that's instructive?
Only one in the sense, and Bob may want to comment on this as well. I tend to agree with his analysis that this is fairly new. If one looks at the Panama operation, which was quite successful, the regime's penetration of society was to a much less depth than it is in Iraq. And so the problem is far more formidable in Iraq. And then, as Bob said as well, you have the problem of still Westerners on Arab land that added another dimension to the conflict that makes this a little more difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Bob?
I agree with Mike's agreeing with me. The there is one historical thing, though, I think we should bear in mind, and that is that historically, generals always plan to fight short wars. They hardly ever turn out to be short. The Panama operation was short and decisive because of the geographical circumstances, the fact that the people knew us. We knew the country intimately. And we certainly would like to
fight. And the leader was removed swiftly and forcefully. I mean, that's another thing where...
Well, but you'd also remember that for about a week he eluded U.S. captors, and everybody was saying the war was a total failure because we didn't have him yet.
Right.
In retrospect, of course, it doesn't seem like that, which goes back to Mike's point earlier about not assuming the glass is totally half empty. But my point is that Panama was the kind of war we like to fight. Fast, short, high technology, very satisfactory outcome. Wars are not always like that. The front end of this war looked a lot like the Panama War, mm-hmm. but the back end of this war is the one we're fighting now, and that's a horse of a different color, and I'm not quite sure that we've got our hands around that yet.
All right, 1-800-423-8255. Next to Manchester, Massachusetts. Susan's on the line. Hi, Susan.
Hello, good morning. I've studied energy economics at the Fletcher School, and I want to ask your guest an obvious but a logical question. And I realize this is not an innocent question. What I want to ask is, what about the idea of augmenting the existing U.S. troops now in Iraq with United Nations troops to make sure, one, that the Iraqi people can begin to believe that the U.S. interest there is not to control their oil, but really was to possibly find weapons of mass destruction, or at the least was really to have a regime change.
And Susan, just before I pass it over to them, are you saying that the use of U.N. forces in Iraq would put Argentinian faces and Bangladeshi faces on the street to persuade, to somehow show the Iraqis that this wasn't just America's move towards Iraqi oil?
Absolutely. I think, you know, right now, as one of your former callers had said, no one likes to have foreign troops banging on your doors and shooting people in your streets, even if they are building soccer fields. Mm-hmm. I think if we really want to put our money where our mouth is, and we really are there not to control their oil, but really are there to take out weapons of mass destruction, whether or not they were ever there, and are there to have a regime change, then let's go about that business, which is we need additional troops, we need to make sure that they don't hate the United States, and get the United Nations troops in there, peacekeepers in there with us as soon as possible.
So. Michael Vickers, would it make any difference if they were wearing blue helmets, if they were faces from Asia and Europe?
Well, I actually think it would be worse. The history of UN operations is only a successful one when all parties to the conflict essentially agree that they're tired of the conflict and basically want buffers between forces. When you have a situation of active resistance like this, as we had early in the Balkans, then the UN model doesn't work well at all operationally. I think that said, I think there is an effort underway right now to bring in multinational forces under U.S. auspices. There have been agreements reached with the Poles and the Ukrainians and others I can't think of at the moment, all supplying a few thousand or more troops to broaden the multinational support there.
Robert, do you have anything to add to that?
Oh, I think Mike's got it exactly right. I've been on two United Nations operations, and in neither case were those troops or was their command structure suitable for the kind of situation we're facing now.
And is that because it can't be made suitable given the nature of the UN, or were those two operations badly designed?
No, the operations were fairly well designed, but Mike's point is right. The United Nations peacekeeping only works when both sides want to see an end to conflict. When one side is bent on war, the UN becomes more of a handicap or a liability than an asset. That recent situation in Africa where two UN peacekeepers were murdered because their own command couldn't get together enough to extract them is an example of what I mean.
Okay, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Thanks for that, Susan. To Raleigh-Durham, North Carolina now. Marcus is on the line. Hi, Marcus.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
I'm concerned about the talk about us getting out of Iraq quickly. I think everybody wants us to be out of Iraq. The soldiers certainly do, and the Iraqi people want us out. But I'm afraid that by taking the easy road and, you know, quickly throwing something together and saying, okay, you're on your own, you know, thanks, that we're just going to open the door for all sorts of problems in the long run. I think now's the time when, you know, we should take this slowly and deliberately and think about the type of government we want the Iraqi people to form.
Don't you think that's going on right now, Marcus? I mean, I remember when General Garner was in there, he was saying, yeah, you guys will be in charge in a month or so, and now he's gone, and Paul Bremer's in there, and there's no deadline. Bremer's saying, you know, we're going to stick with this and stay as a form of occupier for as long as it takes.
That's true. My concern really is with the rhetoric that I'm hearing on the news over and over again. You know, we have comments from people saying, you know, there's this flashpoint building. You know, we need to quickly get out so that you know, we don't have you know, fighting in the streets against the Americans.
No, it's a good point, Bob Killebrew. What's the stomach for a long-term commitment there, according to your view, when you look and listen to what you're hearing from Washington?
Well, I think, or maybe I hope, there's a kind of a strategic reappraisal going on in Washington right now. This administration and the one before it, actually, hoped that we could solve problems like this by going in quickly, solving the problem, and coming out, perhaps leaving a UN residual force. And the evidence of the past several years is that's just not happening. The evidence is accumulating that if we want to go for a regime change, particularly in a culture that's not similar to ours, it takes long-term occupation besides just high-tech war. And I would hope that in the halls of power in Washington right now, folks are beginning to realize that wars like this really come in two phases, the high-tech piece up front perhaps, but then a long-term occupation or certainly a long-term presence. As I said earlier, the evidence from Kosovo, Bosnia, and Afghanistan, and now Iraq, seems to be compelling in that regard.
Are you seeing, Michael, are you seeing a turn in attitude here towards a recognition of just exactly what nation building or occupation or whatever the American presence in Iraq is going to mean over the next months or years?
Oh, absolutely. This administration came to power very much anti-nation building, and now it realizes, for better or worse, it's in that game in Afghanistan and Iraq, and then the inherited commitments that it received from the previous administration. We may recall that you know, President Clinton said we would be out of Bosnia in a year, and then quickly realized that wasn't going to happen. In fact, the only place that we have gotten out of fairly quickly, Haiti, is one of our failures. And so if we're going to have some degree of success like we've had in the Balkans, we're going to be in Iraq for quite some time, and in Afghanistan.
If I could come in on that just for a second. Mike and I have both said that there's a kind of a knife edge we're walking right now between too much and too little in Iraq. I'm not concerned about the military performance over there. I'd like to see more troops in the theater, obviously, but that's a military planner's call. I am concerned, though, that at the higher levels of government, the government may not want to face this problem forthrightly in the coming heat of a presidential election year. There is one similarity to Vietnam that bothers me, and that was the attempts in 1963 and 64 for Mr. McNamara to downplay the problem in Vietnam so that President Johnson could get on with his war on poverty program and other domestic issues.
You mean downplaying it for the president in briefings or downplaying it for the public?
Both. If you read the histories that are coming out now about what was going on in the administration, Mr. McNamara clearly saw it as his duty to keep keep Vietnam well below the horizon in terms of domestic politics. I hope this administration realizes it can't do that, even though the president's already declared that major operations are over.
Michael Vickers, how much of this is going to come down to money, the level of the commitment, the amount that the American government is willing to spend to assist with the reconstruction of Iraq? Because, you know, of course, when we talk about more soldiers or a longer period of time, we're talking about significant expenditures of money at a time when the government is already pretty far in the red.
Well, that's right. You know, one of the surprises or positive aspects of the war is the actual first phase of the war, as Bob Killebrew described it, cost much less than we thought because we didn't use as many bombs and the war was over much quicker. But the occupation, whether it costs more than we thought or not, will be substantial. My institute on the budget side, I do strategy, but the budget side has analyzed that it will be about $20 billion a year. So if we're in there 5 years, it's a $100 billion price tag, which is fairly significant.
And is, yeah, go ahead, Bob.
The other piece of that has to do with the way we structure our forces. Right now, we have a 10-division regular army. We have, I believe, Mike can check me out, 4 divisions in Iraq and pieces of another division amounting to about a division in Afghanistan. If we stay there for the long term, and I believe we must, then those forces have to be rotated eventually. And it leaves us precious little power anywhere else. So that it's more than just the cost of the occupation itself. It's a reevaluation of our national strategy in the war on terror and the way we structure our forces that is looming on the horizon at precisely the time the president doesn't want to hear any more defense expenditures.
Okay, Robert, I have to stop you there because we're out of time. Thanks for being with us today.
A pleasure to be here, sir.
Robert Killebrew is a retired Army colonel and veteran strategic planner. Michael Vickers, thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
Michael is Director of Strategic Studies at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. That's a Defense Planning Research Institute. Earlier in the program, we had with us Eli Lake, State Department correspondent for UPI, and David Rote, in Baghdad, New York Times correspondent based there currently. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
This is WBUR. Coming up next, the second hour of The Connection with Dick Gordon. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Creative Catering in Somerville, providing distinctive food for any event. Catering menus are available at 617-666-4300.